show for great enthusiasm when it comes to opening the doors to try to give people the opportunity to enrich themselves in terms of our own beautiful Jewish tradition. And we're glad to be back, and we certainly hope and we pray that our being here tonight and hopefully gaining a great deal of inspiration will prove to be a source of great blessing for your entire family. God willing. Tonight's lecture is a memorial lecture, the Nathan and Lena Seiler Memorial Lecture. Rebbetzin Deitch, who many of you know, who has a historic role in JEP, together with her late husband, Rabbi Deitch. We are the Rabbi Yaakov Deitch Jewish Education Program of Westchester. When he passed away, I named JEP in his memory on the occasion of his funeral. He was my co-director in directing JEP for the last 5 years of his life. And he and Tibbot Lechaim, she should be separated for life, his Rebbetzin, they dedicated an annual lecture in the memory of Rebbetzin Deitch's parents, a blessed memory. They were individuals who were very active with great enthusiasm in supporting the Jewish community, most particularly Israel. They did a lot in the early years of Israel to strengthen Eretz Israel, and we certainly hope that their neshamos will be elevated in the world of eternity where they presently reside. You might notice that, the title of our lecture tonight, The Gift That Keeps on Giving. Question is, what does this refer to? So there are a number of different possibilities. I have my own interpretation of what this title means. When I talk about the gift that keeps on giving, what I have in mind is Rabbi Leibel Lam, our speaker tonight. He is the gift that keeps on giving. He didn't know that when I told him the title. He had no idea. He thought we were talking about something else. But Rabbi Lam has, what can I tell you? He has, first of all, for JEP, has over the years made an enormous difference. He has come to inspire our audiences. Even earlier this year, we had a very beautiful Shabbaton up in the Muncie area, and Rabbi Leibel Lam came, and he brought down the house. I mean, it was just great. Going back many years, we have had him. And when I say he's the gift that keeps on giving, I'm referring not only to what he does for JEP of Westchester, but I'm talking about the fact that he is a sought-after fountain of inspiration in communities not only across this country, but in other countries as well. He is, Rabbi Leibel Lam is certainly a person who people invite him in if they want to really wake up a community. And, you'll see what I mean very, very shortly. I will tell you this, that I've only spoken now about Rabbi Lam's capacity in speaking to adult audiences. But what he does at the present time, he is the principal of a yeshiva for kids. Many of them are Bukharan kids whose families came out of Russia. Yeshiva Shari Tzion in Forest Hills. They invited him in to become their principal. And I will tell you this, Rabbi Lam invited me and I accepted his invitation. He said, why don't I come down sometime and visit the yeshiva? And I did. And I saw the most beautiful scene. It was a phenomenal atmosphere in the school, and I got to see Rabbi Lam in action. His warmth, he's a magnet. The kids, they crowd around him, and this guy, what can I tell you? He is the gift that keeps on giving. So Rabbi Lam, without any further ado, I would like to introduce to all of you this wonderful evening, none other than Rabbi Leibel Lam, the gift that keeps on giving.
Thank you, Rabbi Zeicher. Thank you. Right. You know, there's a big question, not my question, But the Jewish people are an anomalous people. I think it was not less than the famous historian Arnold Toynbee, who had written about and charted the rise and fall of not less than 26 different civilizations, Hittite culture and you name it, you know, going all the way back into ancient history, all up to modern terms, the Romans, everything. And he found that there was a pattern, that the same way like a tree comes and it blossoms and it gives off its flowers and the fruit falls off, it goes through a certain season, a pattern of where it rises to a crest of success, and then it disappears into the dustbin of history. You can find it in the British Museum someplace. And the Jewish people, he said, are an anomaly. You don't fit into that pattern. It's not normal. We're not normal people. And I think in the 1950s, he lived in the 20th century, in the 1950s, I think he had predicted in an article in Life magazine that the Jewish people by the 21st century, the time that we're in right now, would be extinct. I think I remember seeing in a book someplace that they had written, Rabbi Schiller had written this in a book, that Life magazine is defunct, and Arnold Toynbee is no more. But the Jewish people, you know, here we are, Chai v'Kayam, we're still around. I'm sure I'm going to say something that everybody knows if I read you the famous Mark Twain quote. You know, you get ready, the head start to bob. But you know, it's amazing to hear it. He says, if the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. We're small. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in the world, in all ages, and he has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it, as he writes in Harper magazine. I think he skips down at this point. He says, the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Persians rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was. He's writing in the 1800s. He says, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. He says, all things are mortal but the Jew. All forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? It's amazing. It's an amazing observation by Mark Twain. And so I would like to posit a theory based upon a beautiful Mishnah in Perkei Avos. Okay, and around this time of the year, people between Pesach and Shavuos are learning Perkei Avos. And I'd like to tell you that many times I've had the opportunity to start learning with people the first time that they were learning. You know, right from the beginning, people who had zero exposure. And the question was, where do we begin? So there's one type that likes to begin. Let's say, you know, one fellow told me he saw the movie, but he never read the book. You know, so let's read the book. You know, so let's start from learning Lech Lecha. Let's start from the journey of Abraham, the launching of the Jewish people. And other people said, I'm into it because I would like to get some, you know, I don't want to take the stories and boil them down to the nuts and bolts to get to the principles and the points that the Torah is aiming at. Just give it to me, you know. I want an already prepared meal. Give me something that's going to improve my life, that's going to help my relationship with my wife. Give me something that's going to, you know, give me right away the vitamins that I need. So when I hear that type of talk, I see that somebody's into it for self-improvement. I said, let's begin with Perkei Avos. It's really the only book in the whole oral Torah that is exclusively dedicated to character development and personal refinement. And without any other stories, without any other halachic dealings, and 80% of the Talmud is busy with, you know, figuring out boundaries and defining and qualifying what the halachas are in different situations. It reads like a legal book. But when it comes to the Pirkei Avos, so it's telling us, you know, very, very important things that have daily application to character improvement. So fine, that's where we begin. The truth is, every time we started, I was always left with a question, even if the person himself didn't ask it, but I felt unsatisfied. Because the Mishnah begins like this. It says the following thing. If I fail to translate something, so please let me know. Moshe kibul Torah Mesinai umasar li Yeshua v'Yeshua l'zakenim zakenim l'neviim neviim esaruv li'anshe keneset gadol v'heim amu shlosha devarim hava musunim medin v'hamidu salmidim harbe v'asosil gatorah. Did I fail to translate something? Okay, no. Moshe got the Torah from Sinai, and he gave it over to Joshua. And Joshua gave it over to the elders. And the elders gave it over to the prophets. And the prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. And finally we hear what the men of the great assembly have to say. And by the way, that's, I think, a 900-year spread of passing the ball, you know, shake hands with your uncle, you know, it goes all the way down. 900 years until we finally hear what the men of the great assembly have. It started with Moshe getting the Torah at Sinai, which is 3,326 years ago now. This Shavuos it will have been. All the way to the beginning of the Second Temple, which was 2,400 years ago, right? Which is the time of the end of prophecy. We've been a non-profit organization for the last 2,400 years. And that's approximately 900 years. So Moshe gets the Torah at Sinai, gives it to Joshua, Joshua to the elders to the prophets give it over to the men of the great assembly, who organized the Siddur and many other things for us. And finally we hear what they have to say, be deliberate in judgment. Stand up many students and make a fence for the Torah. Very nice, what they had to say. But why did we need this gigantic history lesson as an entree, as an introduction to finally to hear what the men of the Great Assembly have to say? That was the question that I was struggling with. If there's one book that we have that's dedicated to ethics, let's get to the ethics right away. Tell me what the men of the Great Assembly have to say. This, do this, patient and judgment, stand up many students, and make a fence for the Torah, and leave away the history lesson. Why start with the history lesson? That's what I was a little bit. Yeah. There's other places where we could have knitted together that important chain of how things unfolded over the course of generations, and then we can get right down to business because this is the book of ethics. So here I gave this big introduction. We have a book of self-improvement, and we started with the history lesson. It's like it's a history book. So that was the question. I looked up and I discussed with people. And I tried to find an answer. Sometimes you have a question, you don't get an answer right away. And some of the answers I heard, very nice. We shouldn't think that ethics is an afterthought. It's something that, you know, someone came up with later on. And therefore we should know that this was the original tent that came down from Mount Sinai, these ideas, or something that the Almighty wanted us to be better people too. Maybe it's too obvious. Another idea is that sometimes these Pirkei Avos, these statements, they look like something that might easily fall out of a Jewish Chinese fortune cookie or something like that. You know, they look very like anybody could have said it. My aunt Tilly could have come up with something like this while she was stirring her chamomile tea and doing some aromatherapy. You know, always, never. She could, you know, a couple of always and nevers, and you know, this is what's good and this is what's important. You know, a nice cluster of aphorisms, very nice. You know, no. You should know that this hot lava coming down from Mount Sinai. This is not things that were, you know, that were thought up on a spur of a moment, that were estimations. These are things the telephone line is there on Mount Sinai, and 900 years later, the voice that's speaking out, we have to treat it with that self same importance as if it was coming down from Moshe himself. In order to tell us the importance of what we're about to hear, so that's another reason why we have to have that 900 year to give the credibility, to put the punch behind the words that we're about to hear. Very good. Very nice. Didn't satisfy the big itch. I'm so sorry. Until I heard the following story. And the story goes like this. Again, when I met the original author of the story, he really, really appreciated the application, number one. And number two, he told me that the story is true, and he had changed names in the story in order to avoid that anybody in particular should be recognized. The names were changed to protect the innocent. I'm also going to plug in some variations on the names. And he said the story goes like this, that there was a young man. Unfortunately, his father had passed away when he was a young fellow. And this young man, you know, presented himself to his mother that he wants to take over the family business. And his mother tried as best as she could to discourage him, told him, you know, we'll get along somehow, we'll manage. You don't have to. You just do what you need to do, and you know we'll get along. So he says, no, I want to step up into Dad's big shoes. I want to do it. I want to make it happen. She said, no, no, no. You don't have to. But he decided that he was going to have the audacity and the courage, and he's going to step forward, and he did it. And he stepped into his father's business, and business being what it often is, and competitors being what they always are, they took advantage of his lack of experience, his naivete in business, and before he had a chance to learn those lessons, or just as he was learning those hard-won lessons of business, his accountant came to him, and it came to his lap, and his attention, that something his father had spent an entire lifetime building up, he had fumbled in a short period of time. He didn't know in that dark moment how he was going to face his mother, how he was going to face himself, what he was going to do with all the creditors that were about to line up. He had no money to pay back. He couldn't get the business started again. He realized some of the things that he had done wrong, but it was too late. What to do? And at that dark moment, he sat like a little child, heaving and sobbing and sighing in his father's office behind the big desk that his father sat his whole life. And lo and behold, just at that moment, a knock comes at the door. Come in. Who's this? You know, who do I owe money to now? And a tall, distinguished gentleman enters, reaches into his pocket, and pulls out an envelope. And he drops onto the table in front of this man an envelope, this young fella. We give this fella who comes in a name, Rapinkus. Rapinkus looks into the envelope and starts to fumble through. And he drops the envelope, and this young boy is fumbling through the envelope, and he thumbs through, and he figures out that he has in front of him $50,000 cash. This is an old story, by the way. $50,000 back then was, woo, you know, a lot of geld, a lot of money. Even nowadays, it's still not so bad. And this fella, now looking at this enormous sum of money, and he looks up at the fella, and the fella is just, you know, like presenting it to him. He said, whoo. He says, you know, we were always charity givers. We're charitable people, not charity takers. He says, I'm not accepting charity. Okay, we'll manage. We'll get along. We'll get out of this somehow. And the man says, it's not charity. It's a loan. And the fellow says, loan? He says, I'm not in a position. I'm a credit risk. I've done poorly in business till now. And secondly, I don't have a collateral. I don't have anything, and I don't have anything with what to pay back. So I don't have anything to give you as a mashko and as a collateral I can't accept the loan. He says, don't worry about it. He says, it's a loan when and or if you're ever able to pay it back. I'll absorb the risk. The fellow thinking about his mother, thinking about his situation, thinking about his father. He said, okay, an angel I'm not. He took the money, put it into the top drawer, and when the gentleman left, he invested it and reawakened his father's business. It took him a couple of years, and after that period of time, he had now built his father's business, and having learned those hard-won lessons of business, he now built the business far beyond his father's or anybody else's wildest expectations. And now, with great ease, after a couple of short years, he dips into that same drawer and he pulls out $50,000, stuffs it into an envelope, and proudly marches back to this Reb Pinkus's office and knocks on the door, enters in, and reaches into his pocket and deposits on the desk with a big smile the envelope returning $50,000. Reb Pinkus looks at the envelope, thumbs through, counts $50,000, and says, I'm not accepting it. The young man, stunned, says to him, what do you mean you're not accepting it? You have to accept it. Remember, I told you I'm not accepting charity. It's a loan. He says, I agree that it's a loan, but I'm not accepting it. He says, there's no ribbis in here. I didn't return more. I didn't return less. He says, we agreed that it's a loan. He says, and I don't understand. If you agree that it's a loan, then how come you're not accepting the money? And so this man, Reb Pinkus, he says, let me explain. He says, I've been in business for the last 35 years. He says, I have hundreds of employees. I have many, many people, he says, in charities and whole institutions and organizations that don't even know that I'm their sole source of support. He says, I've been generous all these years. He says, about 10 years ago, he says, I reached too high, too quick. And in one fell swoop, he says, my feet went out from underneath me and I fumbled my whole business. I was sitting there like a little child, heaving and sobbing and sighing in my office, not knowing what's going to happen with these people next week and next month when they don't get that support. What's going to happen with my employees? What's going to happen with my family? He says, I was devastated. And believe it or not, at that darkest of all moments, okay, there's a story within a story, but don't worry, there's an end to the story, so seemingly. He says, a knock comes at the door, he says, and a man comes in. I didn't know who he was. I figured I didn't know I owed this fellow any money. Maybe it's another creditor. And he drops in front of me an envelope. I dig through the envelope and I find out there's $50,000 inside. I look at him, he's as if he's presenting me. I told him, I don't accept charity, I give charity. He says, I'll work my way out of this. Well, we'll build something up, we'll start something else, we'll make it. And he says, no, it's not charity, it's a loan. I told him, I'm not in a position to accept any more loans, you know, I'm stretched, there's nothing left anymore. There's no collateral, like just like you told me. And he said, it's a loan when and or if you're ever able to pay it back. And I accepted it. And I built my business back up. But he told me at that time, he says, if you're ever able to pay it back, he says, don't pay it back to me. He says, find somebody else, a worthy candidate. Find somebody who also needs the help, who's going to do right by the help. He says, research it, find out. He says, and give the $50,000 to that person. He says, the day I knocked on your door and entered in, he says, that was the day that I repaid my loan. He says, and now I'm going to ask you to do the same. Do some research, find out who's worthy, who needs, who's going to do good with this money, and take it and pay the loan forward and tell them and pass on the same message. Because now we can go back and we can revisit our mission in Perkei Avos. And it's unbelievable. Listen to this. It says, Moshe kibul Torah Misinai. Moshe got the Torah from Sinai. We'll see over here now that it's not just a history lesson. There's an ethics in the first ethics is in the history lesson itself. Moshe got the Torah at Sinai, and what did he do with it? Moshe could easily have dug himself into a basement someplace, set up a bunker, gone down, started burning incense, learning Kabbalah. He could have gotten very, very high and very close to the Almighty. And his wife Tzipora, you know, would be banging on the basement door, saying, "Moshe, what is that funky smell coming up from the basement over there? What is that? You know, come on up and eat dinner. No. I'll be out in a little while. And he could have just devoted himself privately to learning Torah, but that's not what he did. Moshe Rabbeinu spent the next 40 years of his life irrigating the minds and hearts of every Jewish adult and every Jewish child so that the next generation would be able to, fathers would be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Vishanantam Levanecha, that you should teach it over to your children. And he so saturated the hearts and minds of the Jewish people that the next generation was ready to carry into Eretz Israel. But before he left this world, he built up the family business and he passed it on to the next pair of responsible hands. He gave it over to Yehoshua, Joshua. And Joshua landed the Jewish people, settled them in for the next 14 years in the land of Israel. He built up the family business, and he brought the Torah now into the land and into the people in a practical way that now they can begin to live a Jewish life, not in the desert, but in a new earthly way. And then he built up the family business and passed it over to the elders. The elders did the same thing. They judged the Jewish people and they settled the Torah into the lives. And then they did the same thing. They passed it on to the prophets. And the prophets also, they prophesied and they warned and they cautioned and they hemmed the Jewish people in with their cautionary words. And they also judged and everything. And then they gave it over finally to the men of the great assembly. And finally, we hear what the men of the Great Assembly say, and they say the same thing. Really build up the family business and pass it successfully onto the next responsible hands. What do they say? They say, Havu Musunim Bedin, be deliberate in making judgments. Okay, we all make great determinations in our life. Where we're going to live, who we're going to live next to, how far away is the shul, right? Who are our friends? You know, where are we going to study? Where are we going to send our children to yeshiva? Who we're going to marry? All these different things, these are great determinations in life that somehow sent us off in different directions. These are the big decisions. Havu Musunim, be very deliberate in making judgments and in these great determinations of life. And have in mind where things are coming from. And the next thing is, V'hamidu salmidim harbe, stand up many students. Very interesting, he says, that the students should be stand-up students. I once saw such a parish like that, it's very important. Judaism is never about and has never been about with somebody, a Rebbe, holding on to people. It's nice to have a group. It's nice to have devotees. I was never insulted when someone said, Rabbi, I'm not coming to your class anymore because there's a Gemara class that's happening. Some guy who came up from the Aleph Beis now, who's learning Perkei Avos with me, is now going to the Gemara class. Good. You know, if you can figure things out on your own, you don't need me anymore. I want my children to balance their own bank book. I want them to be able to to drive a car and to do their own errands without me, you know, tying their shoes and asking for the keys of the cars and $50. I want them to be able to do the things on their own. You can learn on your own. Terrific, beautiful. And have as many students, have as many children, give as much charity, do as much good as you possibly can to build up the family business. That's what it's saying over there. And the next thing is the asusieg l'Torah, and to make a fence for the Torah, to preserve it. If we received a certain gold standard currency, make sure we pass on a gold standard currency. Okay, not to receive a gold standard currency and to pass on a Confederate currency. Right, we have to make sure that whatever we've received, that we're passing it on in the authentic form in which it was received to us, so that the next generation will have the same opportunity. And really, that's what that story is about. It's telling us that the first ethic is, when you receive something good, then preserve it. Build up the family business, do it the best that you possibly can with it, and then pass it on to make sure that somebody else could also have benefited from it. They asked Rabbi Miller one time, what should you do after you were in the yeshiva library and you found a good sefer and you learned it? What should you do? He says, the first thing is, put it back on the shelf so somebody else can find it. You know? Make sure that somebody else can use it also. Okay, that's the minimal. Now, so you see that in that first ethic over there, in that first history lesson, was the first ethic, is the first value of the formula of, and the requirement and the mandate to build up the family business, take the Torah, make the best use out of it, and to pass it on in a legitimate way to the next pair of responsible hands, to the next generation. I know many times, I remember I said this over at a father and son brunch. Never failed. One time even I said this whole story over, nice, we were talking about Pirkei Avos, at one of my daughter's graduation, by the way. She was mortified, 8th grade, right? When that she didn't even know I was supposed to be speaking. I said over, and it always happens. Usually someone from the male side of the species, from that gender, approaches me afterwards and says, Rabbi, where's the guy with the $50,000, you know? they got stuck over there, you know, with the $50,000. Okay, and I don't blame them either. Where's the guy with the, you know, like that's giving out the money like that, you know? And the truth is, we've all had beneficiaries in our life who have helped us out in different ways, a deposit here, and, you know, getting us started, that we owe that type of gratitude to. But the truth is, it's a distraction. If we think about what we have today, that we have a Torah, and we have all the laws of Shabbos, you know, with all of its myriad details, and we have a Sefer Torah with 300,000 plus, you know, letters and hundreds of details. We have tefillin with 30,000 details in the construction of tefillin, and everybody's tefillin is almost exactly the same, black and square with the same parshios in it. It's unbelievable, and we have all of this, and we have Talmid Chachamim. We have people. One of my sons learns in one of the batim in Lakewood. There's 6,000 people learning in one room. And that's one of about maybe 4 or 5 other rooms that are like that. We have 6,000 people that are sitting in a room and learning at the same time. And Lakewood happens to be the fastest growing city in America. The fastest growing city in America. So we think about that we have such a reboy, such an increase, such an abundance of Torah around us. And if we calculate that it was given 3,326 years ago, and we figure in now the blood, sweat, tears, and tuition, right, over all those many years. So what we have in our hands, that we have an authentic Sefer Torah, that we lift it up, we say, Zos HaTorah, Asher Sam Moshe, Lifnei Bnei Israel, Al Pi Hashem, Biyad Moshe, that's the Torah that was given to Hashem through the hands of Moshe, and that's it's word for word the same thing all over the world. Then we know that we have something which is worth, with compounding interest, right? Much more than any $50,000 that anybody could possibly describe. Even to take someone from a childhood up to through seminary, even seminary itself can be, you know, as much as that. We have something more than $50,000. So, you know, to get distracted by that point over there, what we have in having a Torah in our hands is something which is quite remarkable. So we see that's the first ethics that's coded into that little history lesson that looks like it's just an introduction to Pirkei Avos and tells us how to do it and how to keep the ball rolling. My wife and I, we had a tremendous schus privilege that we spent a Shabbos, very, very beautiful, wonderful Shabbos, with Rabbi Pesach Kron. I'm sure everybody heard of Rabbi Pesach Kron. He's a famous demagid, storyteller, whatever. And at that Shabbos, believe it or not, he told a lot of stories. I don't remember any of the stories they told me except one. That's usually how it works. You know, people remember, you know, one thing. You'll leave here tonight, you think you remember, you know, one thing will stay with. I don't know if this will stay with, but this is the one thing that stayed with me from that Shabbos. and this may be the corollary to that piece that we just spoke about a few moments ago. He said there was a young fellow living in Chicago. I think they live in Toronto now. And my son, one of my sons, is, you know, has kept me abreast of their, you know, where they are, what's going on with the different people that are in the story. But it's a true story that there was a fellow who's living in Chicago, and his name happened to be Tzvi Kamenetsky. His grandfather was not less than Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the greatest, you know, one of the great, you know, gedolim, one of the great tzaddikim here in America. I knew him. I saw him in Muncie in his later years, and so Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was his grandfather, and he was living in Chicago, and he and his wife were married for a number of years, and they didn't have any children, but they wanted very badly to have children. They wanted so badly to have children, and after a whole bunch of years of initial marriage, finally. The wife was expecting a child, and somewhere after the fifth month, around the beginning of the sixth month, suddenly, you know, she went into labor and she gave birth to a preemie. You know, something I remember one of my boys told me, that a kid in his class, you know, he used to come over to the house and play, was born 1 pound. You know, like a little, like you imagine, like a little cottage cheese container. The kid was born like a preemie, and he spent the first 3.5 months of his life in a preemie care. In intensive care in a hospital. And they have a whole set of nurses, a whole division in the hospital where they're feeding the kid. They have these tiny tubes and drops, and the limbs and the fingertips and the eyelashes and everything is just so small and so delicate and so fragile. You know, it's amazing what goes on over there. He said, and that's what this kid sat there, and they fed him with an eyedropper, and they were visiting the hospital every day, and the mother back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for 3.5 months. And finally, they built him up. And he was able to get strong enough, he was able to get gesund and healthy enough, that after those 3.5 months, he weighed enough, he had enough poundage, that they were able now to grant a release, and they sent him home, and then they got a clean bill of health after a short period after that, that now they're going to make a bris milah, because he's living for all that time without a name, Plony, that's his name, Plony. And then finally, they gave him a name, they made a bris milah, and they gave him a name, and they called him Yaakov. After his great-grandfather. And the father was so happy. He had his son home. He had a child. He had a son home. And he had the name of his grandfather, of that boy's great-grandfather, such a great person. Imagine how happy he was. And he wanted to somehow to turn around and say thank you to the nursing staff, to the people who had helped his child for all those many months in all that period of time. And he didn't know how to say thank you. And so he sat down and he started drawing up a list of what would he give to these nurses. And he's thinking to himself, flowers, okay, balloons, chocolates. After flowers, balloons, and chocolates, he hit a dead end. That was the short list. He couldn't think of anything else. And somehow that seemed somehow to be trite and inadequate. So Rabbi Kron said, he did something that you and I would probably not do. And he's probably right. He said, in order to find out how to demonstrate his gratitude to these nurses and these people who were taking care of his child in preemie care, he called up his Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Elie Yisvei, Zecher Tzadik Levracha now, who was also one of the Rosh Hashivas in Philadelphia. I had a number of boys myself that went to Philadelphia, and some in their latter years, they saw Rabbi Elie Yisvei in his latter years. But now he's no more, not in this world. But he called up his Rosh Hashiva at that time, Rabbi Elie Yisvei, and he said, what do I do? How do I show my gratitude to these nurses? Do I get them? Which do I get them? All three, or which of the three would Rabbi recommend? Chocolate, balloons, or flowers? And Rabbi Elie Yisvei was a fire. A flam fire. A piece of. He says, don't get them anything. He says, don't get them anything. And the fellow was taken back. Shouldn't get them anything. And Rebbe, you know, I want to show my gratitude. Hapam Odes Hashem, you know, what it means to be a Yehudi, is name of Yehuda, you know, because we're, you know, now I want to show, you know, now I can't stop saying thank you. When Leah had that fourth child, you know, Moda Ani, what am I? I am a Moda. That's when we wake up in the morning. So I'm a thanker, I am an appreciator. You know, I want to say thank you. So important to show a Kars HaTov. The whole Chovos HaVovos is built upon the concept of gratitude, of feeling and expressing gratitude. I would like, she said, of course you have to express your gratitude. He said, what do you mean? Don't get them anything. He said, let me explain. And he asked the following thing. He says, what was the gift? He said, that was given to those famous Miliados, those Jewish mothers, Shifra and Pua, alias
Yocheved and Miriam in the Torah. Listen to what he's, listen to where his mind went. They also, they risked their lives in order to defy Paro, who had a decree against all the Jewish children. And he says, and Hashem gave them gifts, gave them a special benefit. And what did he give them? What? Oh, that, I said the same thing. Okay. It says, V'yashlehem batim, which means he gave them dynastic homes. But if you take a look at the pasuk, there's actually a pasuk that comes before that, that slips under the radar screen. And listen to what it says. V'yetev elukim la mielados. Hashem benefited those Jewish, those nursemaids. V'yirev ha'am, and the nation grew. V'yatzmu ma'od, and they became very strong. The next pasuk, he says he made for them these dynastic homes, Kohen, Levi. So he listened to what the Rosh Hashiva said. He said, you know what you should do? He says, since the benefit that they got was they saw the work of their hands flourish in front of their eyes, he says, come back with that child on his first birthday and say, this is the child that you took care of last year. Come back with him on the second anniversary, on the second birthday, and parade him through and say, this is the child you took care of 2 years ago, this little toddler. Come back with him on his third birthday, his little babbling, and saying, this is the little child. Say, thank you, Yaakov. This is the little Yaakov Kamenetsky. You took care of him 3 years ago. Come back on his fourth birthday. Come back every year on his birthday and say, this is the child that you took care of. Unbelievable. And he said, and that's what he did. The Rosh Hashiva said, do that. He didn't get the flowers. He didn't get the balloons. He didn't get the chocolates. He came back with his child every year, right before the 13th birthday. A couple of weeks became early that year. And he paraded him through, and he hung up a sign announcing that we're having a milestone, a Jewish milestone. My son is becoming a bar mitzvah. He's becoming a Jewish man, and he's going to be 13 years old, and we're making a party. And anybody who wants to come to the party, to the meal, anybody who wants to come to the synagogue is welcome to come. We invite you to share in it. But this is the child that you took care of 13 years ago that now is going to be a bar mitzvah. So they didn't come to the bar mitzvah. But Rabbi Krohn had in his hands a letter from the head of nursing. Listen to this. It's like it's laminated. It's a piece of gold. She writes the following thing. I'll just paraphrase. She goes, I was not around when your child was in our care 13 years ago in our hospital, in this preemie unit. He says, as a matter of fact, most of the nurses that are here now were not there then. And the reason is because it's a very high burnout rate. Because people work intensively into late hours with delicate situations, life and death situations, and the intensity of it, just, you know, people, you know, it's hard to keep up that level of intensity for so long. And so she says, as a result, people are always going on to other divisions and they're leaving through our hands. But we're training people all the time to come into these new spots, these new openings. And when we're training them, you should know that every time somebody comes in to become a part of our, we go through a training system, we tell them, you know that little boy that comes around once a year? Your child could become the one that you're working on right now, that little delicate little 1 pound child. He could become the next Yaakov Kamenetsky, that little boy that comes around once a year. She goes, you have no idea. She says, a lot of people, she writes like this, over the many years, he says, have given us chocolate, flowers, and balloons. And the flowers wilt, and the balloons go out of air, and the chocolate, we know what happens with the chocolate. Okay. She goes, but what you have given us is far superior, is far beyond what anybody else has ever granted to us over these many years. Your child became the poster child for success and the model for what we're accomplishing, because we never see what it is, the future of what it is that we're working on. When we don't know what happens when they leave our hands. Listen, it's unbelievable. Now we go back and we can understand, first of all, the great wisdom of what it means to ask a sage, to ask a real sage, a question, and to hear an honest answer from a great person who knows how to give this type of advice, which is unbelievable. And second of all, you see the practical way that he learns the Torah, which is, you know, that the Torah is kihem chayenu. It's teaching us life. He learns it as a piece of life, not as a piece of history. But I think also what we glean from this little story over here is that a person who wants to say thank you, keeping up with the theme that we said before, takes that goodness that they received And the best way to say thank you to my parents is to take whatever they gave me and to live up to the good qualities that they put in. To take the Torah that we got and that we want to say thank you to Rabbi Zaychik, we can, you know, honor, we can make, it's to say when he sees the work of his hands flourishing in front of him, that's the best way to say thank you, when he sees that people are accomplishing and that they're learning and they're doing and they're building and they're helping and they're building up the family business. That's the greatest way to say thank you to somebody who we felt had helped us and furthered our lives. So that is one aspect of this concept over here of we have a Torah that we received. It took 3,326 years to come into our hands. And the first ethic is to take the Torah that we received and to use it in the best possible way to build up our lives and then to pass it on to the next pair of responsible hands. That's the best way that we can say thank you. Now, I'd like to just visit very briefly the second mission in Perkei Avos, which I think has really teaches us that it might cement in the same idea that this is really what the theme is in Perkei Avos and in Torah. And it says the following thing. Shimon HaTzadik was from the remnant of the Knesset HaGadol. There was 120 people, and when they all passed on, there was one man standing, Shimon HaTzadik. He was the last one. He was the end of that era. And he said the following thing after the three great pieces of advice that we had before. He says, Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, the world is standing on three things. Al ha-Torah, v'al ha-avoda, v'al gemilus chasadim. That's what he said. So what does it mean, Torah, avoda, and gemilus chasadim? So Torah, okay, I have a question. The Torah, it says just one word, Torah. It could have said, okay, we can summarize them. Torah means that's the way Hashem speaks to us. Avoda means that's us speaking to Hashem. That's prayer. Okay, Kerbonos, the prayer. And Gemilas Chasadim is the way we conduct ourselves, and it's part of the way we conduct ourselves in this world. But my question is, when it says Torah, it says one word, Torah. It could have said Limud HaTorah, learning Torah. It could have said Asik HaTorah, like we make a bracha. It could have said a lot of different words that to accompany the word Torah, but it said one word, Torah. Three things the world stands, the pillars of the world. And then it could have used, and it didn't have to tell us three. It just sort of said, the world stands on Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim. It tells us three things, like we need all three. All three are important. So Torah, one word. Avodah, could have said Avodah Shebalev, the work of the heart, as prayer is called. It could have said Avodah Beis Hamikdash. It could have said Avodah, going out to work. It's not clear. Avodah. What does Avodah mean? One word. Suddenly it comes to kindliness and it says Gemilas Chasadim. What's the meaning of Chesed? Who said Chesed? The world stands on Torah, Avodah, Chesed. Keep everything one word. Now suddenly it's Torah, it's Avodah, and it's Gemilas Chesed. So I would like to posit that there's a difference between Chesed and Gemilas Chesedim. And I'll explain from a different angle, and we're going to put a bow on things in a few moments. What is the thing, Chesed? I actually spoke to some scholarly audience, and people are scratching their heads. I didn't think about it. What is there between Chesed and Gemilas Chesed? Now, in Hebrew, it's interesting. In the Hebrew language, different than, I'm sure you've heard discussions about these type of things also, Hebrew language is different than every other language. It's more like a chemistry set. Right? In English, C-A-T, cat. There's nothing about the letter C. There's nothing about the letter A. And there's nothing magical about the letter T that tells you about a little, you know, feline creature with a tail that's interested in chasing and eating mice. It doesn't tell you anything about that, except it's just telling you it's a phonographic language. It's telling you how to pronounce it. That's all. C-A-T. You put a B in front of it, now it's B-A-T. Okay, that's all. Now it changes it to something else. And a bat could be a baseball bat, or it could be, you know, this blind rodent that flies in the air and catches flies and sends out 60,000 sonic beats at a second with a great sonar system. So maybe that's what it is. So we don't know from the English language except how to pronounce something. Interesting, in the foreign Eastern languages, it's pictographic languages. You only know what something looks like, how to pronounce it. In Hebrew, it both a phonographic and a pictographic at the same time, tells you how to pronounce it, right? Bayit, you know, beis, yud, tav. And there's also the shapes over there in each of the letters. I can prove to you, demonstrate to you that the bayit, the beis, that the letter beis, really means a house. Not because it looks like a house like that, One great Tani says, I never called my wife, I called her my house. What is that supposed to mean? A house? He called it a house, the brick. We're thinking, you know, the gutters and the whole thing. If you take a look inside of a letter pay, I happen to have a sitter that has the letters as they appear in the Sefer Torah, Ksav Ashuris. And every time I look inside the letter pay, pay stands for actually Pnei, the surface inside the letter pay is a kosher white, and white is outlined the letter Beis, because Beis stands for the inside. When Noah was putting the pitch on the to seal in the ark, he put it mibayis ubachutz. He put it mibayis, which means on the inside, ubachutz, and on the outside. And the same thing we find, the gold that went into the aron inside the Holy of Holies was also smeared, and the gold was on the inside and the outside. Mibayis means on the inside, like the letter ba, the prefix means in. So when this Tana said, my wife is not my wife, but she's my house, he means she's my bias, means that she's the whole internality of the house. Otherwise, all I have I have a house. Now there's a home. She gives the whole spirit into the home. There's something that's special about the Hebrew language. So if we want to know, let's say, Gimel Chesedim, it comes from the word Gimel. Gimel, like the word Gimel, letter Gimel. So not only is the name of the letter also is an indication of what the meaning of the word is. And the first time it's used in Chumash without a prefix is also an indicator. So the first time a gimel, let's say, is used at the beginning of a word, like we said, pnei, the surface, is represented by the letter pei, because that's the first time it's found not as a prefix. And if we discount the prefix, that's how it's used at the beginning of a word. So the letter gimel, the first time it's used, it says me'oros hagadolim. And then later on, taninim hagadolim. It means the great lights. That you discount the hey, and now you have the letter gimel for something gadolim, for the great lights, great. So whenever we find a letter gimel at the beginning of a word, it somehow indicates something is growing, something is expanding, something is increasing. That's the word, that's the letter gimel. That's what the letter gimel means. And if we think about it, so if we want to take a look at we spell out the letter gimel, gimel, mem, lamed, spell it out. Now if we spell gimel, mem, lamed, we have the letter gimel, which means grow, and mal means cut, like bris milah. Growing, cutting, okay? We're trying to figure out, it's a little bit of a puzzle. And then we figure out the name of the letter, gamal. What is a gamal? What?
Camel.
A camel. Good. So what's the specialty of a camel? What is a camel good for? And I'm going to open up a rent-a-beast center, and people are going to come by, and they're going to want to rent an animal. So guy says, I got to carry a piano across the street. So I have a donkey. You take a donkey, and you know, he'll carry it for you, and that'll be good. I have a letter I have to carry to the other end of town. Oh, I have a swift running Arabian horse. That'll be good for that. You know, you have to know what tools to recommend for different clients. Guy says, I'm taking a long, long trip, and I don't know when the next fueling station is going to be. Oh, you need a gamal. You need a camel, because the camel has the ability to fuel up, to absorb a lot, and then to cut himself loose, and then to go and to reach the next destination and to reach the next source. That's the concept of gamal, right? So now we can come back and we can understand a little bit about what gemilas chasadim is in 1 second. And the first time that we find the word gamal is used in Chumash is, here's a quiz question. Boom, 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 boom. Dun, dun, dun. Gamal. Bum. What? I'm sure I was thinking that maybe some people are going to say by Eliezer, right? When he went with the 10 camels and he met Rivka by the well. But I found it was something at a much earlier point. And it says, listen to this context. It says, Yitzchak had finished growing up to 2 years. I guess now he had teeth. And he could eat pizza at the table. And he doesn't need to nurse anymore from Mommy Sarah. So this is the first real party that we found in the Torah. One of my rabbis made a calculation and figured out that it came out on Purim also, because whatever, it was an Uber Shana. He says, V'yigdal hayeled, the child grew up, Yitzhak finally was growing up, V'yigama, which means he stopped needing his mother. He weaned his way away from his mother. I don't need mommy to feed me anymore. I don't need mommy as a drink box anymore. Not Sarah anymore. V'yas Avraham mishta gadol, and Avraham made a mishta gadol. He made a great party. B'yom higamel, on the day that he weaned Es Yitzchak. He weaned away Yitzchak. So what is Gemilas Chasadim? Gemilas Chasadim means a program of kindliness where a person fills up somebody else, they help them to the point where now we, like we said before, Vahamidu Salmidim Harbe, they're able to stand up on their own and then to carry on and to take it further. Like a tree grows a piece of fruit and then the fruit falls off from the tree. It rolls a distance, gets carried a distance, and then finally it sets down roots and forms a new tree. It's not just a random act of kindliness. Right? Sometimes you see a bumper sticker like that. Do a random act. That would be chesed. You need $10? Here's $10. Yeah? You need some help. You need a tow. You need a gas tank. I can give you a gas tank. I can take you, you know, I can fill up the gas and be right there. I can do that for you. But Gemilas Chasadim is a program of kindliness whereby the person is doing something for somebody that they're able to pass it on and they can do it further to somebody else. They can help out somebody else in the future. Like the old Chinese proverb says, give a man a fish and he has fish for a day. Teach him how to fish and now he has fish for a lifetime. Give somebody a lecture. This is not the preferred style. And he had a couple ideas percolate in his mind. Teach him how to learn and then he can have students and he could potentially now go teach and learn and teach other people on his own. That's the ideal. That is the secret and the success of the Jewish people is that is this concept of Torah Avoda and Gemilas Chasadim is to raise up other people and to teach people with a program and to have a program that we're going to raise them up, that they should now go on and should be able to raise up the next generation and teach and do something for somebody else also. That's the secret of the success and the survival of the Jewish people. You know, it's an amazing thing. If you take a look, my family came to the New York area and they settled in the Bronx. I'm sure some other people are going to tell me the same thing. The Bronx, the Bronx. My wife is from the Bronx. Both my parents are from the Bronx. The Bronx at one time had 500 Orthodox synagogues. 500 Orthodox synagogues. People didn't know any different. There was nothing else. You came there, you did it. You did it the legit way. The way that, you know, it was done in Europe. 500 Orthodox. It's hard to find anything there that's worthy now. And there were many communities like that. I went to Providence, Rhode Island. I went to, you go to Chelsea, Mass. You go to a lot of places. Gone. My father's parents grew up in Harlem. There's many, many neighborhoods that there. We can't even imagine that there was ever a really a strong and a solid and a flourishing Jewish population there. The ones that are strong and flourishing nowadays, Lakewood, we mentioned. Queens, Forest Hills and Kew Garden Hills, Brooklyn, because Shraga Feivel Mendelovich started with Torah Vadas. And then other places, Cleveland, Tel's Yeshiva. In Queens, we have Chofetz Chaim Yeshivas. Wherever the yeshivas put down roots, so they started creating new fountains. If you have a synagogue is nice. It's like, you know, you have a car and you need a 20-minute lube job. It's nice. You go there, you don't get an oil change, car's going to break down. You got to go there for Mincha, Marav, and a few Mishnayos. It's nice. If you happen to have a Rav there who's a Talmud Chochem who knows, you know, how to learn and knows how to paskin, so that you have mechanic on premises. Very nice. But if you have a place where they're producing cars, where they're making the next generation of cars, Lansing, Michigan, whatever, I don't know if it's doing much these days, yeah. So then it's the new cars that are rolling off the assembly line, the new Hassan Kala that's coming out, with the new families and the new children and the new generation, the new next generation that are learning how to learn. That's the survival of the Jewish people. That's the continuity. So this Torah is really the secret of the Jewish people. That's the gift that keeps on giving. And we're finding out about it. And we're thinking about it. How important it is to our very existence. Forget about, you know, there's other mystical and protective aspects to it. But just to the way that we've continued to continue is only through basically this learning of Torah. Wherever it hasn't existed, so the vines have withered. Wherever it's been invested in and it's been built up and it's been cherished, so then it flourishes. I just want to share with you, we'll finish up with something, an amazing piece of paper I have in my hand. I was looking around for it. I have it copied in my computer someplace, but I can't always find it when I want it. It's unbelievable. My wife and I were engaged now 29 years ago. At the engagement party, shows up amongst all the Rabbanim, everybody there. I went to Or Sameach and Muncie at the time. And, you know, room filled with all my friends, all Balei Tshuva, all guys that are all starting later in life. I myself, we've spoken, I said, of my life story. I didn't start till I was 23, 24 years old. I walked onto the campus at Or Sameach. Okay, we'll save that, you know, in case anybody didn't hear, for some other time. And now, 3-4 years later, I'm engaged, Baruch Hashem. And my wife has an uncle from a family that almost everybody was wiped out, but a few little pieces of parts of the family, remnants, you know, finally were, through one person, were able to get back in touch. My mother-in-law's maiden name was Friedenzohn. She had an uncle, famous person in the Jewish world, who passed away last year. He just had his yahrzeit, his first yahrzeit in his early 90s. His name was Yossel Friedenzohn. Yossel Friedenzohn went through 7 concentration camps. His father was one of the founders of the Beis Yaakov movement in Europe, Yossel Friedenzohn. I'm sure you've heard of Reb Yossel Friedenzohn. An amazing word. His son, Goldings, is a Chofetz Chaim fella, and his daughters, many of them, are married to Chofetz Chaim boys and learning and teaching in Queens. So he shows up at this old Holocaust fellow, one of these little fellows that, you know, that's not taller than the top of the stand over here. He shows up at the Vart. And he speaks every year at the Aguda convention. A fella, clean-shaven fella, you know. But he's writing a bi-monthly newspaper for Agudas Yisrael called Das Yiddish Avart, with 2 fingers on a non-electric typewriter, and 3/4 of the articles have to do with nostalgia and about what was lost during the Holocaust. That's his whole obsession. So he stands up at this event. One of the Rebbeim said, "Nu, Yozel, Zug, say something, at this, you know, festive event." And he goes, "No, I'm not an English speaker." I remember sitting right there. I heard the rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva coaching him. "No, no." Encouraging him. "No, say something, Rabbi Yossel." "Oh, I'm not an English speaker. I'm not an English speaker." He says, "Nah, Rabbi Yossel, you can zug just fine in English. Go ahead, go. Yeah, good, please." He goes, okay. After a couple of times, the person's asked to speak. He stands up and he speaks. And he says the following thing. First of all, he looked out at the audience of people. And he says, "Where do you people come from?" I'll never forget that. "Where do you people come from?" Looking at the faces of people who were just starting late in life to learn. And then he said, quoted the Talmud, it says, "Torah makzir and alaksanya shalot." Torah returns to those people who hosted it. He says, "You wouldn't be here today if you didn't have parents and great parents and great great grandparents who coughed up blood, who gave up their lives that this thing should be kept. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here today." I remember, wow. And it's true. Then he went and spoke about my wife's illustrious family tree, going back to the Ramah, going back to other great luminaries. That's what you do with a Vart. You try to get a little chizuk about who's the Chassan, who are you getting? There was nobody to tell anything about me, but my wife, she'd realize who I'm getting and which family I'm going into. And then he said, "If I would have known I was going to be here today," he says, "I would have brought with me a document," he says, "that solved the problem that's been troubling me for the last, at that time, I think it was 35 years. He says, "I write books and I write articles, everything about the Holocaust." He says, "I lost my whole family." He says, "I'm obsessed with the Holocaust." That's his thing. That's what he says. Admittedly. He says, and everywhere, he says, "I always found," he says, "what was the final solution?" We know Hitler had a final, Yimach Shemah had a final solution. He says, "We never found it, and I was always looking." He says, "What was going to be if he, Chas V'Shalom, would have been successful in Europe? What would he have done with America? What would he have done with the rest of the world? We had a plan. We knew what his plan, what his wicked, crazy, maniacal plan was for European Jewry. What about the rest of the world?" He says, "Nothing." As if maybe he didn't think he was going to win. It brings up questions about what, you know. And they were thinkers. They were, you know, they were planners. Very, very, very careful, detailed planners. Good question. He says, "If I would have known I was going to speak here today, I would have brought with me a document that I held in my hand today for the first time." He says, "that answered this question." And they spoke about it. And then when Reb Moshe Scherer passed away, who was the head of Agudas Yisrael for 50 years, they printed in that Jewish Observer, it doesn't exist. The Das Yiddish Vort is still pumping out, I think, until Rabbi Yossel now passed away a year ago. And I found this piece of paper, which is the document with a partial translation on the side. That's the document that he was referring to. And the document says, this document transmits a memorandum dispatched from I.A. Eckhart, Yimach Shemo. And here it is in German over here, on a torn piece of paper, a copy of it. He says, from the chief of the German occupation power, listen to this. It is an order dated October 25th, 1940, from Das Rackenstrackens, or something, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Where is the vowel? The central offices of the German security forces. That's one word they have in German like that. To the Nazi district governors in occupied Poland. They went from Germany right to Poland. Why'd they go to Poland? Instructing them not to grant exit visas to the Osterjuden, the Jews from Eastern Europe. The reason behind this order is clearly spelled out. The fear that because of their orthodoxen in Schlugen, whatever, their orthodoxy, these Osterjuden would provide, that these devoted Jews would provide, he says, the rabbiner and the Talmuder, the rabbis and the teachers of the Talmud, who would recreate the Striegen Unterstrugen, the spiritual regeneration of Jews in America and throughout the world. So they knew that if you wanted to kill this beast, you wanted to kill what they felt, you have to, this is the jugular vein, get rid of the Talmud learners, get rid of the Torah, get rid of the children. That's why they went after, he said they went after a little child, if they could find a child, because the child was the future. And get rid of those people who learn the Talmud. Then he said then the Jewish people would wither and they would die on their own. Listen, sometimes the enemy knows us better than we know ourselves. So now we can go back to our mission in Perkei Avos, a beautiful mission in Perkei Avos. It sounds like a nice thing, you know, be deliberate in making judgments. It's a nice idea. Stand up many students. It's also a nice idea. Be influential. Try to do the best that you possibly can. Very nice, right? And make offense for the Torah. And now we understand that what we find in Perkei Avos is really, that's the formula for the Jewish staying around to the 21st century over here. We're the least likely to be here. And why are we here? And what merit are we here? Even the people sitting over here, where do people come from? Torah Magzir and Alexanya Shalal, like Rabbi Yossel said. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have parents and grandparents that cared so much about this that somehow they couldn't let go. They need a child, they need a grandchild, somebody who's going to be attached to this thing even so many generations later. So I think that this is the gift that keeps on giving, the fact that we have a Torah, and the Torah says, build up the family business and give it on. And I think the real novelty over here is the following thing. Maybe we'll just finish up with this one last little point, and that is that since Moshe received the Torah on Mount Sinai, and Gemilas Chasadim merely means to pass it on, that means that even while somebody is in the taking mode, and they're learning, it looks like I'm selfish, I'm only taking, if they understand that I'm going to take enough that I'm going to be able to give later on, or I'm going to be able to give at some point to somebody else, then that taking is considered like they gave. Even the taking part, that somebody is sitting and listening, or they go to a class, and they, well, this is, you know, I wish, you know, so I feel like I want to get, no, take as much as you can. That camel has to fill himself up. That's Gemilas Chasadim. Gemilas Chasadim means take the time and devote the energy to fill yourself up, because that's not called taking when you know that your taking is in order to build up your resources in order to be able to have more to give. And then the person himself, everybody at that point becomes, anybody who looks like they're in the taking mode, they're sitting in yeshivas. My boys are sitting in yeshiva and they're learning. Some people want to know, what are they doing? They're taking. Look like they're taking. But they're taking in order to someday be able to give. So that taking, therefore, becomes a form of giving. It's not called absolute taking. So therefore, the gift that keeps on giving is anybody that devotes themselves to the Torah, and it looks like at this point in a taking mode that they're building themselves up and they're learning and the camel is filling themselves up, but they're filling themselves up for a long journey that they should have something to give over to other people, and therefore that taking is a form of giving. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And I think that's the secret of how we got here and where we go from here. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions for Rabbi Lamb at this time? Comments, questions?
You have a copy? Machine here? So most homes have a copy machine these days, you know, even though, yeah, so we can get a copy, that would be great, yeah. This one happens to be a laminated copy with some other, on the other side, flip side over here, I have this famous study. It's a harsh study over here. I'm sure some people have seen it. They start off with, you know, different stripes and allegiances of different Jews, and with 200 in each category, and given the current intermarriage rate and the current replacement population, how many children, so how many people will be sitting in those seats in four generations, you know? And in one or two categories, it increases, and one increases, you know, exponentially. In another category, it dwindles down to almost zero in just a very short period of time. You know, they asked, I once heard from Reb Elchanan Wasserman, who's one of the famous students of the Chafetz Chaim from Europe, and I heard directly from him. He says, let's say somebody's one day he's going to come up with a synthetic potato. He was a genius of a person, Reb Simcha. Someone's going to come up with a synthetic potato. A synthetic potato. It's going to look like a potato. It's going to schmeck like a potato. It's going to taste like a potato. It's going to have all. It's going to look like a potato. It's going to fool you to think he's a potato. Yeah, that is a cute way of talking. He took these great ideas and collapsed them into these small little parables, like this. He says, and then you're going to put it next to a regular potato. You don't know what's the regular potato, what's the real potato. You're going to get confused. He says, there's always a way to find out. He says, you put the potato in the ground. If it produces another potato, he says, then it was a potato. There's an organic element over here. You know, if it's got to produce itself. It's producing itself. I'm saying it's pushing forward. It's encouraging
Our reality is that we are here in Westchester County, and we have very limited resources in terms of filling ourselves up with water for the journey through the desert. Do you have any advice that you could suggest in terms of, you know, and sometimes we weren't given the $50,000, maybe we got $50. And the question is, how do we build ourselves up so that we can pass on?
So I'm hearing before about somebody, he goes once a week to Chofetz Chaim in Queens. It's 25 minutes in here, 20-some-odd minutes?
45, 50 minutes,
okay. Other people come up to Or Sameach to spend time. And plus, I drive around in my car. I have Shas in my car. For about $150, I have an MP3 player in my car. So I'm just listening to Masechta Sanhedrin, the Agadata, you know, given by Rabbi Meir Schwab, the son of Rabbi Shimon Schwab. So I have a chavrusa while I'm driving around. I used to have, I don't want to tell you who my chavrusas used to be in the car, but I turned them off. I said to myself, listen, you know, time is short, the work is much, the workers are lazy. You know, nowadays a friend of mine told me, he says he has it on his, you know, they have all these little Aishmai, you know, these boom, 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 boom. You know, I happen to have a very primitive phone. It doesn't do anything except make phone calls. How unique, right? But my car has an MP3 player, and I'm listening, I'm driving around, listening to Shirim all the time. The Eli Mansour tapes. There's Rabbi Victor Miller tapes. Okay, sometimes a little bit straight and strong, you know, but there's lots of others. There's unbelievable Reboy, incredible amount of them. I'm sure there's a Jep library also, has all kinds of different, not tapes anymore, CDs. A person could drive around all the time. Sometimes I'm sitting out in front of the store waiting to go in. My wife says, you know, I'll be home in a few, you know. I'm sitting in the driveway waiting for the rabbi to finish the point. Sometimes, you know, we think we have to go to a place anymore. We don't have to go to a place. Call a Lushan, Torah anytime. I can't tell you how many people, I went down to Florida, I said, people tell me, you know, I'm watching all your lectures on Torah anytime. Torah anytime. Torah anytime. 24/6. Right? Right there on the computer. The opportunities these days are almost endless and equal to anybody who has access to, you know, the you know, just generic equipment that everybody seems to have in their hands these days. Of course, those same pieces of equipment could lead the person into a wrong direction, but if properly employed, you know, anybody could be listening to, could be learning 6, 7, 8, 10 hours a day. How much time we spend in the car waiting at the doctor's office? You put something in your ear, and suddenly you're listening to an inspired cheer by who knows who? Rabbi Zeitchik, right there. Yeah. We don't have to show up someplace. It's not a location anymore. Someone said, that's why Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, never remained holy. Isn't that interesting? Mount Sinai was never, It was never remained a holy place. Because it's not, as Rav Hirsch says, because it's not about the place. You know, it's not about, oh, I learned in yeshiva. You know, it's like, take it with you. Now it's portable. Take it with you. It's meant to be, you know, all over the world. It's meant to take it wherever you have it. Uvelech the chavaderech, or shach v'chav kamecha. Now in the days we can fulfill the mitzvah. Uvelech the chavaderech. When you're going on your way. I'm thinking that's, you know, that could be, that's available, equally available to everybody. Person doesn't speak Hebrew, it's in English. You want to sit down and look at a piece of Gemara that, when I went to yeshiva, when I started learning Gemara, there was no art scroll. We had no help. Sensino, but that was like learning it in Old English or something like that. Archaic, you know, Jastrow we had. Jastrow and we used to sit there and write down the column of the words on the side, you know, the translations and put like a little, you know, an index. You'd put, you know, A, Heche, B, but, you know, you write all the words. And I figured once you'd understand the words, then everything was okay. Only to find out that I felt like Mrs. Einstein. Right? They asked Mrs. Einstein one time, you understand what your husband says? She says every word. Just the sentences I'm having trouble with. That's all. Still got to think, you know. But if a person wants to learn, he says, now at least you have an art scroll Gemara. So no one's locked out. It's unbelievable. The opportunities are endless. And I know people who never went to yeshiva a day in their life, and they became qualified learners. They accomplished more than people who went their whole life and then sort of like, you know, let it wither on the vine. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's a long distance run. And I can tell you stories about people who started late and accomplished a lot. They were persistent. And even if they were listening to one guy, I gave him his first Rabbi Avigdor Miller tape. And he listened to thousands of them and distributed them all over the place. He found something he was excited about and he made a whole industry and a whole accomplishment for himself just encouraging other people. Here, listen to this. Here, a few more. Here, when you get done with that one, give me it back. And he's, you know, passing them around. He found some of these tapes he liked and now he started, became a distributor in a good way. Wow. Person be Mazaka the Rabin can do unbelievable things these days, can really inspire the masses and not even be the speaker himself. So I think there's, you know, there's opportunities around. And then, you know, helping build JET and helping that more people should come in to find out that there's other opportunities outside also. Because people don't know to tune into that channel until they come and they get a little flavor of it, until they come into a lecture. You know, let's build up JET. That's our Torah institution over here. That understands it and gives people the flavor. Once you get that flavor, then they're going to want more. Where do you get more? So everybody's like, I don't own the Torah. No, you know, make yourself available to Riverdale. Make yourself available to Yeshiva there. Make yourself available to Chabad Chaim. Make yourself available to Ur Sameach. Make yourself available to a Talmud Chacham someplace who can help you. Rabbi Zaitzi is not going to be jealous. Talmud says there's two things that a person's not jealous of. His children and his students, right? You hear that your students are doing great? You know, that's me. It's not, you know, I can't feel jealous of them. It's not a competition. There's no competition. Okay.
Thank you, everybody. Before we get up on that note, we have the JET dinner coming up.
Oh.
There are invitations on the tables if you did not get one. And on that note, I would encourage everybody to, you know, bring a friend. Tell a friend. Bring somebody with you. And if anybody needs a ride, a lift, or whatever, you can certainly contact Rabbi Zaitchuk and he'll help everybody, make sure everybody gets there. And let's hope we're all there, that every single person in this room is there and actually bring somebody, encourage somebody, motivate somebody, and let's all learn.
By the way, the dinner is it's our 25th
yes.
anniversary dinner.
Wow.
So
yes.
It's a historic year for us, and June 1st is the special day.
45.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, a special year.
Who's counting when you're having fun?
So it'll be a very special dinner as well.
25, wow.
Right?
God willing, yes. Yeah. We are making some very special plans. I want to thank Rabbi Lamb for his splendid presentation, and we hope that the Almighty will grant him many, many more years and opportunities to continue as the gift that keeps on giving.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Marie and Ken for their spectacular hospitality at opening the home tonight. They invite everybody to enjoy them for refreshments. In 5 minutes from right now, we'd like to make a minion for Margaret right here in this room. So that would be wonderful.